You are listening to workshop number 4, Inside the Net, delivered by guest speaker Scott Radner for Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School on Saturday, October 22, 2005. Visit us on the web at www.fas.harvard.edu/CSCIE1.
Good morning, good afternoon, or whatever it is. It's amazing that you're still here after all this time, but okay. I'm going to talk about the Internet. Talk a little bit about the history of the Internet, where it's going, where it may not be going, the regulation, what's going on in the regulatory space, why some of the basic characteristics were important, and why they're under threat. So the first question is, why is there an Internet? Where did it come from? There's alternate theories of where it came from. You've heard that it came from trying to design a network to survive an atomic attack. Well, that's sort of right. Back in the mid-60s, when the Internet stuff started, it was called the ARPANET in those days. That was a network created by the Defense Department. There was work being done by a fellow named Paul Barron at RAND. It's a research group out that contracts for the government. Specifically about building a command and control structure would survive an atomic attack. Now, some of you look like you've been around for long enough to know that time period, where you were taught to duck and cover under the flimsy table in the classroom in order to protect yourself from the atomic bomb. Well, it was a tough time, and it was a time when atomic attacks looked not unlikely. In the mid '60s, Paul did his work in '64 and the like. So he was off there busily trying to create a network that would survive an atomic attack that would blow up half the country. And you could still use it to tell the remaining half of the country to go fight the commies or something. Meanwhile, Larry Roberts and a few other folks were trying to figure out how to share computers. In those days, computers were very big, very expensive, and very few. There were a handful of them around. But there were researchers all over the country in various educational institutions and research institutions which would like to use computers. But those computers, by the way, are slightly less intelligent than your wristwatch as today. It's big improvements done in this space. So they wanted to be able to share computers. Because they couldn't afford to put a computer in every university. That's just far too expensive to do that. In today's dollars, it was like $50 million per computer. And you couldn't put that in it. The federal government couldn't put that in every university. But they could put a network in the university so that the individual researchers in that university could connect up remotely to a computer. So Larry Roberts is working on that. Paul Barron is working on the command and control structure. And they're both designing exactly the same network. They don't know it. Larry told me that it was years after Paul had done his work that he even knew about it. And, of course, Larry Roberts says nothing of Paul Barron's work ever got into the Internet. And it's exactly the same if you go back and read the papers, which are online. They're at the RAND site and online. They're very interesting. So it was created. The funding came from when Larry Roberts went to the Defense Department and headed up DARPA, which is the Research Projects Agency there, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. So he's the one who actually got the money. So in a way, it must be that it was there for sharing computers. But it is the Defense Department. They probably had something else in mind. And so there's probably a little bit of the anti-war stuff going on there, too. So what was it that they did? Remember, in those days, the world was telephones. There wasn't data networks. There was telephones. You could pick up a telephone, and you could dial somebody else. Or you had to go through an operator if it was certain kinds of calls. But you could make telephone calls, voice calls. There were some data connections, but they were all done by the telephone company. There wasn't something where you and I could set up our own data links. So what did they decide to do? They decided to build a network. Well, that didn't come out so good. Anyway, decided to build a network which sits on top of existing networks. This was a key decision. They did not decide to bring out new wires and string them all over the planet. They wanted to use existing telephone wires and layer on top of that a new network. In order to do that, you had to create a layer. We call it a bearer service now. a bearer service to isolate the type of network from the application, because you had lots of types of networks. You had Ethernets and token rings. Actually, this is all before both of those, but there's lots of different kinds of networks, all different vendors, different management areas. All of these things are all different, and yet you want to be able to communicate end-to-end over this. So you had to make something that hid the complexities of the network. That is called Internet Protocol, or IP. Of TCP/IP, IP is this Internet Protocol. It's designed to transfer data between networks, which is why it's called InterNetwork, the Internet Protocol. And so it was the Internet Protocol. It sits there as a bearer service. It hides the complexities of the network underneath, allows applications to run without knowing about networks. It allows networks to transport services without knowing about the applications. Very important thing, and you'll see a little bit later on. So the first thing was to use packets. And though in the early days, the telephone world and the telephone world today is still circuits. When I place a phone call to you, I pick up and I dial, and the phone system sets up a dedicated pathway between me and you, between my phone and your phone, actually. And it's dedicated, and it's reserved for the length of the call. Nobody else can use it. But that means that all along the path between me and you, there has to be state. There has to be information about that particular phone call kept in all of the switches between the two ends. That's called circuits. Packets, on the other hand, are little things which you can't really see here, but I think you can probably see in your handout. They're little chunks of data. Instead of having a phone call being one continuous stream, you break it up into chunks, and you send these chunks individually. In the chunk, the first thing in the chunk is a destination address. That's what the self-describing talks about. It describes where this packet is supposed to go. I can send packets out of my computer, successive packets to go to different places. In a circuit-oriented world, it can only go to the other end of the circuit. With packets, I can say, I want this packet to go to you, and this packet to go to you, and that packet to go to Google. And the packets themselves say where the packets are supposed to go to, which means that the devices which are forwarding these packets can be very simple. All they have to do is look at the destination address and decide which way to send the packet. And they're sending these little chunks of data. It's not a continuous stream. Unlike the phone switches, which have to have lots of apparatus in there to keep track of the millions of phone calls that are running at the same time. The router, which is what's being used to forward packets, is just a special purpose computer. It looks at destination address and forwards it. It's very simple. I mentioned it's using existing networks. That was the Uber goal, the highest level goal, according to Dave Clark, who wrote up the design philosophy a few years afterwards. And he said the primary goal was to use existing networks, not to build a new one. How many here have heard of ATM? Not the things that you get the yuppie food coupons out of, but the networking technology. Okay, that's about what I would expect, not just because of your background, but because the ATM was a very, very big thing about 5 years ago. It was going to be the next networking technology. It was going to take over everything. And it completely failed. And it's almost unheard of today, even amongst the experts. Almost nobody knows about it because it failed. It failed because it assumed it was going to replace all existing networks. You're going to build an entirely new network. All new wires, all new connections. And that would never run because it's too expensive to get that going. So the ARPANET runs over existing networks. Support multiple types of survivability, so that if individual routers get destroyed, whether it's an atomic attack or a hurricane like Katrina, then the rest of the network can keep running. In 9/11, there's a lot of internet stuff in the World Trade Centers. There was almost no effect on the internet on 9/11. The level of traffic declined, and that was because instead of people being at work, working away, they were at home watching TV. And so that the level of traffic on the internet went down, and it was really almost no effect at all. There were some places whose wires terminated in the World Trade Center, and they were taken off the net. They were taken off the air. But almost everybody else was completely, didn't bother them all, kept going. Same thing with Katrina. There was very little effect on the overall network just because the routers and the wires within New Orleans were destroyed or lost power. Everything else kept going because it was the design of it, which is all of these little teeny routers connected up in redundant ways so that if any one fails, another one can take over. Support multiple types of communications. One of the general fallacies of networking these days is you design a network for a particular application. You design a network so it'll support voice, or you design a network so it'll support video. That means that's a special purpose network. Means that if somebody comes along with something that's slightly different, then it won't run because the network wasn't designed for it. The internet specifically was designed without caring what the application was going to be, without even having the faintest idea what applications were going to come along later. And because it has no specificity there, you can keep inventing new applications to run over it. You're not tied to what the network designers thought was going to be used for. So you've got that degree of flexibility. And you will see a little bit later on that's been critical. Variety of network types, that's an existing networks thing. Everybody runs their own little piece of the internet. It's not one global. There is nobody that runs the internet. Harvard runs part of the internet, the part of the network, the internet that you've been using here in this room. That's part of the internet, but that's a piece that Harvard runs. Harvard connects to an internet service provider, two different internet service providers. They each run part of the internet. And other companies run parts of the internet. So there's no one person that runs the internet. There's no one person to blame if something goes wrong, unfortunately, if something. It's supposed to be cost-effective, supposed to be low-cost, and supposed to be accounting. These actually have not borne out, accounting in particular. We actually don't know how much things cost because nobody ever bothered to actually make accounting work very well for the internet. This is coming back to haunt us today, and we'll talk about that in a bit. There was no, in the original design decisions that Dave Clark talked about here, he's a researcher at MIT, a very important person in the internet history. There was no design goal for security. That doesn't mean security is not important, it just means it wasn't one of the original goals. That's come back to haunt us. Because your laptop and your desktop at home is instantly invaded by viruses whenever if you turn it on straight out of the box and haven't patched it. It gets completely wiped out and you get spyware and all kinds of stuff on there. But there wasn't a goal. There wasn't a goal for defining what quality of the network is going to be, what service is going to be provided there. And there was no goal of efficiency. It was more important to have flexibility than it was to have efficiency. So those are the original design goals. What else? Well, support diverse technologies, as in different kinds of computers, different kinds of laptops, or wireless, or PDAs, or anything like that, cell phones, etc., all different kinds of things. The original design goal was to support all that range of stuff and to use this internet work address, which I've already mentioned. The fundamental architectural principle of the original internet design is called the end-to-end principle. And the end-to-end principle says that if I take a packet and I create that packet on my computer and I send it across a series of internet service providers to you, that the same packet that I sent gets there. That nothing in the network has to give permission for this particular kind of packet. So when Google came along, I came in the middle of you being shown by Google. When Google came along, Google did not need permission from AT&T or MCI or any other internet service provider to run, because the end-to-end principle said that Google could put up a web page, you could send things to Google through your web browser, and Google could send things back to you, and nobody in the network would know it any better. It wouldn't be there getting in your way, and they wouldn't be there trying to help you. It was just out of the sight. So that meant that Google could innovate and produce this new kind of functionality without having to get permission of the carriers. It's a very important feature. This has led to the incredible innovation spree that we've had that's been the internet. It's billions of dollars worth of value. Just see Skype. Skype is a telephone, an internet-based telephone system, which sold for as much as $4.1 billion if they meet some of their goals. That's not bad for two college kids. They're just off on their own. And that's another case of they didn't have to get permission from any internet service provider to provide you telephone service over Skype. You could just go download the software and start using it. And nobody has to give you permission. Your local cable company doesn't have to. The big backbone providers don't have to. Nobody has to. So it's just going along. By the way, if you have any questions as we go along, stick your hand up. Don't hesitate. So the end The end-to-end principle says the network is neutral. The network stays out of the way. It's actually worded slightly differently. It says that if the end system, your computer or my computer, is the system that understands what it wants from the network. It may want reliability. It may want a certain level of the bandwidth. It may want a certain kind of security. The network can't know that. The only systems that can know that are the ones at the end. And so the end-to-end principle says, let the ends do something where they're the only ones that know. The network's there to transport packets. This is known as the stupid network. That's a phrase that was coined by a fellow named David Eisenberg, who was at that point a researcher at AT&T, which was the phone company in those days. Very quickly, he was not a researcher at AT&T anymore because this paper said the AT&T circuit switch, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of apparatus was unnecessary. All you needed to do was transport packets from end to end, and everything else would just flow. You could do voice, you could do video, you could do Google, you could do all that kind of stuff without having to own the content, without having to understand what was flowing over it. It just worked because the stupid network just transported bits, just transported packets from one end to the other, transported data. David's a nice guy, quite nice guy. He wrote this paper. AT&T decided that he could wander off someplace else. If you go to the website, which is listed on here, the pointer to it is listed on here. It's a nice read. The paper's very easily read paper. But if you go there, you will find that AT&T has prohibited him from putting this paper up on his website. Since he was an employee of AT&T when he did it, they could do that. But on the website, there's pointers to other people who weren't employees, and they put it up. So AT&T is still trying to squash that, even though long, long time ago. But if it's end-to-end, the end-to-end model is there. That means the network doesn't know what's going on. The network doesn't know what application you're running, doesn't know you're running a video stream or an audio stream or running Skype or just doing Google or sending a letter to your mother-in-law. The network doesn't know. If the network doesn't know, how can it provide the quality of service that might be necessary? If you're doing streaming video, you need a lot of capacity out of the network. If you're sending a letter to your mother-in-law, you need almost nothing. How does the network know to do that? It doesn't. And this is a problem. With a datagram-based end-to-end model network, the network can't know what the application is and therefore can't decide to give you more or less capacity, to give you different timings of the packets. But it also can't charge you extra money if you're running a valuable application.
What was the term you used, datagram?
Datagram and packet are the same thing. Okay. Us geeks tend to mix them up. So there's no quality of service model, which the network can't give you better service if you pay them more money. And it comes down to there's no business model for the Internet. The Internet service providers themselves are selling packet service. They're selling a packet delivery service that they agree to deliver your packet to Google. And they agree to take the packet back from Google and deliver it to you. But that's commodity. They're doing nothing, no value add to that. So that one ISP looks, the Internet Service Provider looks just like another ISP in terms of what service they can offer. They can offer packet delivery, which means that they'll tend towards the cheapest possible, you as a customer will tend towards the cheapest possible provider. This is very much like the airline industry. It's the stupidest competitor that decides the price. The competitor who's willing to undercut everybody else defines what the price is. So one of the biggest problems we have in the Internet today is no Internet service provider is making money. They're all losing money. They're all losing money at different rates, but they're all losing money. So we have no business model for the Internet which will sustain it, which will mean that we will have an Internet tomorrow. Somehow we got to figure that one out because we can't keep losing money for a long time and make it up in volume. It's just not going to work. But we'll get back to that. So a little bit more about quality of service. Not only does the Internet not have any quality of service mechanisms, and not only does it not be able to because it doesn't know what application you're running, in theory, the end could tell the network, I want better service now for this application because it's an important application to me. In theory, you could do that. In practice, that's hard to do. But The other part of the problem is that in the U.S., at least, and in parts of Europe and in Asia, parts of Asia, the network works almost all the time extremely well. So a value proposition of you paying the internet service provider more money to get better quality service falls down when you get as good a quality as you possibly can without paying them more money. So that this is Mike O'Dell, who was a researcher, was a technologist at UUNET, one of the big internet service providers. The internet fails to fail often enough so people think it works. It doesn't fail reliably enough so people think it works. So there is a big, this is what I said at the one of the traditional standards bodies for the telephone network, when they're trying to come up a whole new infrastructure for the internet in order to provide guaranteed service. I said, the internet isn't reliably crappy enough for that. If it was reliably crappy, then you could go and say, give me more money and I'll give you better service. But you give them more money and they get the same service because it's as good a service as you can possibly get. And this is part of the business model question. The other factor about the end-to-end model, there's no binding between your carrier, the people that the internet service provider provides internet connectivity to Harvard or to your home, and the services you want to run. For example, email. Harvard can run its own email server. Harvard could subscribe to Hotmail. At home, you could get a DSL or a cable modem line internet provider. You could use their mail server, or you could subscribe to Yahoo, or you could subscribe to Hotmail. And if you do either of the latter, then the local provider, the one who's providing you that DSL line or cable modem, doesn't get any money for it. They only get the monthly fee for the use of the line. So there's no binding between the carrier that's providing you the internet and anybody who wants to provide services. You can set up a dirty joke website and provide services there and get people to subscribe to your dirty joke website and collect the money for that, and the DSL provider or the Harvard's internet service provider wouldn't know about it and wouldn't get any of that money. So anybody, this is the disconnect between the service provider and the connectivity provider means the connectivity provider isn't getting money. It's just a commodity. This is just another way to talk about the fact that the internet service provider does not profit from the applications that run over it. And that's a problem. Dave Clark, the same one that I referred to earlier, said that we know how to route packets, we don't know how to route money. Routing a packet is deciding which path it should take to get to the destination. We don't know how to take money from a service provider like your Dirty Jokes website. And you could pay, in theory, the internet service providers to give your customers better service. But we have no mechanisms to do that. So even if you wanted to do that, you couldn't do that. But you wouldn't want to do that because that would take away some of the money you'd make. So you wouldn't do that. So this is more along the line that we still don't have a business model for the net. So we've got all of that. We've got the end-to-end model. We've got the disconnect between the service providers and the connectivity providers. We've got all of those other things in there, and we don't have any regulations. The internet in the U.S. is not regulated at all in any way, shape, or form. There's no regulations that say that internet service provider has got to connect to internet service provider or that a particular set of services have to be offered or anything. There's just no regulations at all. So what passes for the architecture of the internet is an ad hoc thing, that individual internet service providers say, oh, I'll connect to you, and I'll connect to you because it's my business interest to connect to you because you got some good customers, and my customers want to talk to your customers, and therefore it's worthwhile, but you don't have any good customers, so I'm not going to talk to you. It's a completely ad hoc. Any individual internet service provider can make out its own business decision as who else to talk to. So that means you get an internet architecture that looks something like this. This is a picture of the internet. It may look kind of funny, but it is really a picture of the internet. These different colored spider things, those are different internet service providers. And this is how they interconnect. There's no way to tell what's going on there. I don't have the faintest idea what's going on there, other than there's a lot of them. There's a lot of internet service providers, and they have different scopes, bigger and smaller. And that's all you can tell. You can't tell how they interconnect. You can't tell who's talking to whom. And so you can't tell if you're sitting here and you want to go get service from an internet service provider, which one should you use in order to get best connectivity, the highest performance and highest capability to your customers or the people you want to be your customers? How do you do that? You don't. There isn't any way to do it. So there's no defined internet architecture. So we've got the end-to-end principle, which says that the network's unaware of what's going on. We've got the lack of a business model because the carriers can't force you to use their services. We've got an interconnection model which looks like a Rorschach test, a bad Rorschach test. At least the Rorschach test, at least you can see dirty pictures. This one you can't even see that. So what does that yield? That yields a network that the traditionalists say can't work. So anybody know what that is? It's a bumblebee, actually. If you look at Google and you ask for bumblebee, Google images bumblebee, that's what you get. So why is that? Why did I put a bumblebee on the screen?
Is this not supposed to fly?
Aerodynamic theoreticians back about 15 or 20 years ago proved that bumblebees couldn't fly. They missed something. Actually, they missed the boundary conditions on the hairs, I think, is what they finally figured out. But it took them years and years to figure out that bumblebees could actually fly, even though their computer said they couldn't fly. I was a manager of a group within an IBM user group called Share. It was a very big, important IBM user group when IBM was very big in the computer business. And IBM came in and they said, you can't build a corporate data network out of TCP/IP. That was a direct quote. You can't do that. And the rationale behind it was they had a definition of what a corporate data network was, which was their own protocol called SNA, which had all kinds of controls in it for security, for quality of service, for access, had all of these controls. And their definition of a corporate data network was that, something with all those controls. Since TCP/IP and the Internet had none of those controls, then of course it couldn't be a corporate data network by definition. At Share, you have little stickers you put on your badge to show what you're interested in so that you can meet people in the hallway and know what their interests are. If you're interested in communications, it's an octopus because the tentacles sort of go everywhere. Interested in numerically intensive computing, it's a circle with a 42 in it, and if you don't know what that means, you couldn't get one. If you don't know what it means, go out and read Hitchhiker's Guide. We chose a bumblebee for our symbol, for the TCP/IP project. And that was because IBM had said TCP/IP wouldn't fly. Aerodynamic theoreticians had said bumblebees couldn't fly. Bumblebees didn't care. They kept flying. And we didn't care. We kept flying. The Internet kept flying. So we have a history. Some bumblebees do fly. So what's the history of the Internet? Here's a psychological history of the Internet. Back when it started, back in the 70s, it was 69, was when the first connections were made to the ARPANET. It was just the geeks. And these are the people that actually connected up the first router in the Internet. This is from Bill Brannick and Newman, which was a company up the street here in Cambridge. And these are the people that set it up, and that's the first ARPANET router called an IMP, an Interface Message Processor, which Ted Kennedy sent a congratulatory note for the interfaith message processor. Getting slightly wrong, but he's not a geek. So starting at the beginning, it was just geeks. And it was enforced so. Harvard got connected to the ARPANET right about here, about 71. We were not allowed to let students use the ARPANET. We weren't allowed to let faculty use the ARPANET, except those faculty who were getting directly paid by the U.S. government. I wangled a connection because I got myself as one of the staff members on the connecting computer. Of course, I wasn't a staff member on the connecting computer, but I knew somebody who was, and so they gave me an account there. So I got on the net in about 72. And my email address has basically been the same since 1972. But it was only us geeks. We couldn't let anybody else on at Harvard. We had to put up special barriers to not let anybody on. And that went up until 1981. So it's a long period of time when nobody could get on except for a very select group of geeks. 1981, there was something called CSNet, which Harvard joined, and they had done a deal with the Defense Department that let any student and any employee and any faculty member of Harvard or any of the universities who were both a CSNet member and an ARPANET connection use the ARPANET for email. You couldn't use her for file transfer, but you could use her for email. Of course, we didn't pay attention to the latter part of you couldn't use it for file transfer. You use it for everything. But this meant we started creating a generation of students who understood that email worked, that they could instantly communicate with somebody in Australia without you picking up the telephone. And it had some big advantages of the asynchrony of email, of not actually having to get the person on the other end of the phone, which, if it's Australia, sucks. That's a technical term. So we created this generation of students who knew this. They went out to business and said, wait a second, you mean I can't do email here? I'm not going to come. So the businesses went out and they joined CSNet in order to get their connectivity, in order to entice the better graduates. So we started, this is the real growth of the Internet here. This is the psychological growth. The real growth in terms of importance to the business community, research community, started growing very strongly right in here because of the CSNet deal. Businesses such as IBM and Digital Equipment Company joined, got their connections to the Internet at those days, the ARPANET in those days. You couldn't do business over the ARPANET, but you could facilitate research. So Digital Equipment Company, which made computers, facilitated research by selling computers to research organizations. But that wasn't business, you see. That was just facilitating research. The fact that it was a price list came along with the facilitating research letter, so be it. Then we had a big spike of public awareness of this Internet thing. In 1988, in the fall of 88, November of 88, when Tom Brokaw got on the NBC Evening News and said, everybody has to change the password because the Defense Department network has been invaded. Well, this was Robert Morris's Internet worm, November 4th, 1988. Robert Morris was an undergraduate here at Harvard. He went to Cornell to do his graduate work, thank God. His graduate work consisted of releasing the first worm on the Internet. Which infected maybe 10% of the computers, the 60,000 or so in those days computers on the net. It invaded about maybe 10% of them. We don't know how many it did. But it got 3 days in a row. The top story on NBC News was this secret Defense Department network, which wasn't secret at all, was now invaded. So now we had a big psychological thing. We had this network out there that the average person tended to know about. Because this was the day when the average person actually watched NBC or CBS News. That's not the case today. And then the web came along. 1992-ish or so, Tim Berners-Lee from CERN figured out that the researchers at CERN, the physicists, don't like to type, and they're not very good typists, so they want to point and click instead. So he came up with this whole scheme, which is now what you were just seeing in Google, is this URLs, where you click on it, you click on something, and it connects you to another place. It brings you up a file. It brings you up data. That was invented by Tim Berners-Lee, who is now Sir Tim Berners-Lee or something. He got knighted by the Queen. At CERN, the cyclotron outside of Geneva. But then everybody started using it. And by 1997, my mother was surfing. That is my mother. I was asked earlier this summer, looking back 15 years at what the network was then, what was the biggest surprise about what happened with the network, the Internet? And I had to answer, it was my mother surfing. It would have never occurred to me 15 years ago that this was going to be anything but a geek's toy and something in the background. Companies would use it because their computers would know how to connect things there. But that the average person would use it to go get maps or to go get directions or restaurant menus. It just never occurred to me. It just plain never occurred to me that Mom would surf. And so, but Mom was surfing by 1997, and that was the network started really, really, really getting big. Big, 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 big. Irrational exuberance, Alan Greenspan said. It certainly was. Venture capitalists were making huge amounts of money. They'd throw money at some project, it would come back tenfold. Even if they didn't think at all before throwing the money, it would still come back tenfold. It was a ridiculous time. Amazon.com got founded, was losing money at a great rate. The greater the rate they were losing money, the more money the venture capitalists put into them. It was wonderful. We had sock puppets. There were some pundits were saying the network and the traffic on the Internet was doubling every 3 months. I say 3 days there to be facetious. because it wasn't doubling every 3 months, it was doubling every year, but said that MetroNets is local area networks, local area Ethernets in the metropolitan area. Huge amounts of money went into that. No results at all. Everything was going over IP, the Internet Protocol. Everything. Voice, video, data, anything. Shoe size, anything went over going over IP because the answer was IP. What was your question? But looking back at it, that's the balloon. That's the bullet. And that is a real picture of a balloon just about to get hit by a bullet. And the world dropped out. Remember, this is a psychological picture. So the world dropped out. And $1 trillion, literally around $1 trillion of real money, not inflated funny money, but real money, $1 trillion went away. Bang. Lost because companies folded, that sock puppet, pets.com, selling 50-pound sacks of dog food through the net. Now, who could have thought that that was a good idea? Well, venture capitalists did. They put a lot of money into that, and it folded. Of course it folded. The sock puppet has a second life as a spokes puppet for an auto insurance company now. Everybody deserves a second chance, is the phrase, which is a neat hack. So $1 trillion went away. Now, you may think that's a lot of money. It is. Even for Harvard, that's a lot of money. But if you compare it to the railroad boom in the beginning of the last century, early 1900s, there was the same kind of boom where it was a rising stock market, an astronomically rising stock market for the railroads. Everybody went out and bought railroad stock because railroads were just taking over the world. $3 trillion in U.S. and today's dollars were lost when the railroad stock collapsed. So we're only a third of what the railroads did. And some 900 million or so were lost in the canal boom. And around $1 trillion was lost in the Dutch tulip bloom boom back in the earliest. The first one of the big stock market runs was Dutch tulips, where they kept bidding them up and up and up until they finally figured out, you know, they actually have to deliver the tulip someday, the tulip bulbs. And when they actually started delivering the tulip bulbs, there was no money there. And so they collapsed. But that was the first big one. So this is just another one in a series. We've had no infrastructures that have paid for themselves. Railroads, canals, roads. Those roads are publicly built. Telephone. Telephone paid for itself. How did it pay for itself? Because it was regulated monopoly. And whether you wanted to like it or not, you were going to pay enough money to pay for that phone and pay for all of the extra costs, the regulatory costs on it. And so it was a guaranteed profit. Telephones paid for themselves in the mid-1960s after having started at the early part of the century. So it took a long time even for that. So infrastructure doesn't pay. So that was the psychological picture. The world ended, and then it stayed ended. I mean, the Internet's nowhere. You can't get any venture capitalist to supply any money to the Internet know-how. Any Internet protocol stuff, they're just not going to send any money to it because they lost so much. And then 2005, it starts creeping up a little bit. And then early 2005, Amazon makes a profit. Now what's going to happen? We actually have a proof that you can actually do something over the Internet and make a profit. The VCs are coming back. They're now actually doing deals, venture capitalists. I'm an advisor to one group, and they're making some progress. So the world had ended. Psychologically, the world had ended. But is that reflecting what did happen? And the rest of the world. Well, let's look at some. Number of Internet hosts kept growing. Through all this whole phase, it kept growing. Large ramp up. The number of websites kept growing. The number of Internet users was a little dip. It flattened off for a little while just at the end of the Internet boom, but it started growing again right after that. The spending on U.S. information technologies kept growing. Was a little dip up there in 2002, which was more a recession rather than the Internet boom ending. And retail commerce has kept growing. This is the seasonal, you know, Christmas and the rest of the year cycle here. It went from 0.7% to 2.2% of the total retail economy is now Internet. So all those kept growing. So despite the fact that the world ended psychologically in the Internet, that didn't stop the real world from keeping going. So the real world kept going. So it wasn't quite as dire as it appeared to be. But despite all of that, but all of that growth, some people still don't believe in flying bees. The traditional standards body thinks that the internet is broken, significantly broken. They had a seminar here at Harvard a couple of years ago where they brought in some big head of a Lucent research lab and an IBM research lab and somebody else. And they said, quote, the internet doesn't work, end of quote. Despite the fact that it sort of looks like it works and when you click on things, things happen, it's not working. And they say it's not working because you can't define what working means. In a telephone, you can define what working means. Working means you get a 64 kilobit, 64,000 bits per second connection between me and you, and it has a certain the phone call has a certain quality, so we know what working means. What does working mean in the internet? When you click on a URL and it comes up and it doesn't say 404, does that mean working? Does it come up fast? Does it come up slow? When Skype's when you're using Skype, does it sound good or sound bad? How can you say what working means? But because it doesn't work, in their mind it really doesn't work, they have to fix it. And those traditional telephone standards bodies are out there busily trying to fix the internet. They're trying to make it as reliable as a phone network. Well, in Katrina and in 9/11, you couldn't use the phones. Your plane couldn't use them because they overloaded. And they overloaded. Even the emergency workers, the way emergency workers use the telephone system is you get a dial tone, you dial a special area code, the special area code 710, that's a special area code for emergency workers. Emergency workers are the only ones supposed to use that, and then you dial a phone number, and then it prompts you for basically a calling card. And there are about 50,000 emergency workers that have these calling cards. And so that you're then given priority on phone calls. But this is all predicated on getting the dial tone. And you couldn't get a dial tone for a long time after 9/11 and during Katrina. You just couldn't get a dial tone. So you couldn't do step zero. There was a woman here at Harvard whose husband was scheduled to be on one of the flights that hit the World Trade Center. And he went to the airport, and he went early, and he transferred to a different flight, which he probably didn't realize was a one-stop, not a non-stop. It went through Chicago instead of direct to L.A. It actually would only get in 10 minutes earlier. But he was the next to last person of the standbys to get onto this flight through Chicago. So he wasn't on the flight that hit the World Trade Center. But when he landed in Chicago, tried to call his wife back at Harvard, he couldn't get a dial tone. It took him 4 hours to get a dial tone. So it was the couple-hour flight to Chicago, plus the four-hour time before he could dial tone. His wife thought he was dead. And it was just, it's that kind of thing. How useful is it in an emergency when you can't use it? How useful is it, how reliable is something when you can't use it when you really need to? So the design of the phone network is a design which doesn't allow for that kind of emergency use. The internet kept working through all of that. If he could have gotten in a Wi-Fi hotspot, he could have sent email, and it would have worked just fine because there wasn't any disruption. I was using it constantly to send email and use the web. CNN went down because it overloaded. It wasn't because the network went down, because CNN's servers were overloaded. Wanted to make it as secure as the phone net. Well, actually, how secure is the phone net? Turns out the phone network is designed as a private network, a closed private network. And the security consists of it's closed and the door is locked. Now, if somebody happens to be inside that locked door, then it's not secure at all. There's actually no security in the phone network at all, as was demonstrated by Kevin, Metnick, who used to whistle into phones and get free phone calls and things like that and hack into voicemail systems. There is no security in the phone network. It's all false. It's all false because they've got this idea of a walled garden that somehow all the bad guys are going to be outside. Well, all the bad guys don't stay outside. As controllable as the phone network, they think that they actually can control it. Well, actually, governments can. Governments do control the phone network. They can say you got a wiretap here and you got to block this kind of call, et cetera. The internet, you can't do that with. I don't think that's a bug. I don't think it's a problem that the governments can't control who you can call. Make it as profitable as phone network. Remember what I just said. The phone network is profitable because of its regulated monopoly. You are paying three times as much as you need to for the service of a landline phone, because the regular monopoly says that's what you're going to pay. I've got a curve later on comparing the cost of cell phones per minute to the cost over time for the cost of landline phones over the minute. There's actual competition in cell phone space, and the price is now down to approximately what it actually costs to produce it. So the price is a reasonable price compared to what the landline phone is, which is unreasonable. So profitable is the wrong term here. If it's the if the government is guaranteeing you a profit, that's not a good thing.
Can I ask you a quick question?
You can. And they did that because Nepal only has, I think it's one or two internet connections to the rest of the world. Actually, it wasn't as simple as that. It was there was some government involvement in shutting it down. But it's the, in some countries, China, Nepal, number of African countries, there is only a few connections out of the country. And if the government comes along and turns off the switch on the router, the packets don't flow. And the net's down. In a place like Germany, there's a dozen internet service providers and international connections. In the U.S., there's hundreds of international connections. So the government couldn't come along and just turn off one computer and shut everything down. But in some countries, it's still that case. Now, it didn't shut everybody down, because it didn't shut down the people who were getting internet via satellite. But it did shut down the ones that were getting it via the landline, the fiber. I remember that case. There was a big stink about it for a while. There was another case where Pakistan was without internet service for weeks because the undersea fiber cable, some fishermen snagged the undersea fiber cable. There was only one path into Pakistan. So.
Is it very expensive to establish an internet
connection?
To become an ISP?
It varies. One of the most dynamic areas that's going on right now is something called WiMAX, and WiMAX and Wi-Fi. They're wireless internet connectivity. There's a Wi-Fi station in here someplace because I was using it a few minutes ago. It's wireless. The Wi-Fi is extremely cheap. You can put up a base station which will serve 100 people for under $200. Then you need the internet connectivity behind it. So you need to get some internet service provider connection. That can be anywhere from $50 a month to hundreds of dollars a month, depending on what speed you get and how far away you are from the internet service provider. There's a lot of grassroots ad hoc networking going on, particularly with wireless in the U.S., but also in a lot in developing countries. There's a huge explosion in India and Africa of situations where they bring a wire out to a village and they put a wireless hub there and that serves the whole village. Of course, it's easy because a lot of the villagers don't have computers, but they're working towards that. MIT has described a $100 to $200 laptop computer that they hope to be able to produce for that situation. So it really depends on how far away you are from the internet service provider to get what is called backhaul, the connection between you as the local provider and the rest of the internet. And then, depending on what technology you use, if you run a wire to everybody's house, that's expensive, labor and equipment. But if you can use wireless, it can be very cheap. And so, there's a lot of growth in the wireless space. We'll see some interesting stuff in that space. So there are alternatives to the internet. The telephone company that's trying to make things work, make it so the internet works instead of being broken the way it is, the intelligent network. That's what the current telephone network standard is called. They call it that. It wasn't David Eisenberg calling it that. It was they themselves call it the intelligent network. And that is a network where the services, the applications, are in the network itself. So you have an application like *69. Which calls back the person that just called you and didn't make it through. That's a service. Go away. Okay. That's a service that is in the phone switches. And it took almost 10 years for the phone company to develop that service. but the intelligent network is that kind of thing, star 69, and those functions which you hit the star keys for within the phone system are intelligent network functions. Local number portability, when you can take your phone number and change it over to your cell phone or change providers and the number follows you, that's part of the intelligent network. It's a database that is used there. Another alternative is what the ITU is working on now, the International Telephony Union. That's the standards body that's in Geneva. And this is their design for the next generation internet. This is a little complicated. The existing internet is about one-tenth that amount of functionality, number of boxes. But that's what their model is. But both of those models, the intelligent network and the NGN, assume no end-to-end, no EDE principle. They assume that they're the ones who are going to describe what applications you can run, what content you can get, and they're going to get value out of that. So if you want to watch a Disney movie, you don't go to Disney, you go to Verizon. You go to the telephone company and say, I want to watch a Disney movie, and they provide the movie for you, and they charge you for it. Whereas with the internet right now, you can go to apple.com and download a video and watch it on your iPod or on your desktop, and none of the carriers are aware of it. And they don't like that. I don't know if you've been following the whole iPod controversy, the Apple iTunes iPod controversy relative to the music industry. Music industry was kicking and screaming into selling music online. They thought this was a devil's tool and they were going to run away with it. But they reluctantly agreed to do an experiment with Apple Computer and to do this. And, of course, it was okay to do it with Apple Computer because that's 4% of the market. So it's not a big threat. If it only works on Apple's, then what the hell is the problem, as far as they were concerned? So they reluctantly agreed to do it. And it turned into incredible success. And Apple expanded their server to work on Windows, so iTunes works on Windows. The iPods have 80% of the music player business. It's a phenomenal success. It produced, as of a month and a half ago, $350 million worth of revenue for the music producers. The music producers can make more money off of you downloading a CD's worth, an album's worth of stuff off of iTunes than they do if you go buy a CD. Because it's actually the same approximate price from Amazon and from Apple iTunes, and they don't have to actually make anything to build anything. So they make more money, but they don't think they're making enough. So right now they're trying to hold up Apple to make it so that they're forced into allowing a higher price. And one of the music companies say, they're selling a lot of iPods and we're not getting any of that revenue and we want to get some of the iPod revenue. As if people buy iPods just to listen to his company's music. And so it's that level of stuff. And that's what the carriers expect. The telephone carriers expect the same thing. They expect to be part of the value proposition. And so that when you want to go look at something or download something, a program, a file, a music video, whatever, they think they deserve some of the money because it's their network. The president of SBC, one of the big telephone companies, said at the end of last year that Skype is stealing service off of my network and not paying for it. But the customer has paid for that wire. I, as a customer of an internet service provider, pay for the wire. I say, I want internet connectivity. It's not that I want internet connectivity, I want you to collect for something else. I want internet connectivity which allows me to access all kinds of services, including Skype, if that's what I want. But his mind is, there's value running over this wire, and I'm not getting it, so therefore it's theft. And so there's push on that space. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday about how telephone companies and DSL and cable modem companies are starting to inhibit the ability of customers to access content in order to force it so that they can only access it through themselves, through the carriers.
Are you going to talk about the Google controversy also?
Which particular Google controversy? Google seems to be particularly good at making controversy.
And all those other publishing companies that are upset.
I wasn't going to, but that's the Google print stuff. And Google is scanning a lot of books. including a bunch at Harvard. Well, actually, this many at Harvard and this many at University of Michigan. And yet Harvard shows up first on all the lists. It's great. Great being from Harvard. It does that sort of thing. It's 40,000 volumes from Harvard and 6 million, I think, or no, 5 million or something from Michigan, and yet Harvard shows up first in all of the news stories. It's great. The publishers and the artists and the authors have both said, this is terrible, terrible, terrible. Google wants to produce it so you can, if you search for something, it'll produce little excerpts, like one paragraph long excerpts of the book. Not enough for you to actually do anything. And you can't search for adjacent words and get any more. They actually have some interlocks in there, so you actually can't get very much. Google, because this is fair use, and there's fair use concept in the laws, but the artists and the publishers say it's unfair, it's copyright violation. My guess is what this is all about is Google. Well, they want a slice of pie, and they deserve it. As an author, I believe in the copyright system. But I think it's Google going about it the wrong way. Yahoo is going about it slightly differently, which is that they go and ask the publisher, do you mind if we scan your stuff? And publishers have generally said, okay. Google just says, we're going to do it. We're Google, and we're going to do it. If they had gone to publishers and said, okay, here's our plan. We want to do this thing. If you say, okay, we'll scan the books that we run across that are yours, and we'll have this little button beside it which says, oh, I want to buy that book. Even if it's out of print, you know, go to local Kinko's and pick up a copy. And so therefore the publisher and the artist would get direct money from it. If they'd done that, then the publishers would have gotten their greed satisfied, well, for temporarily, and they'd then later on find more greed, I'm sure, just like the music publishers have. But this is not a technology question. It's really a business model question. But it's an interesting thing. It's in the courts now. Two different lawsuits from different people, different groups, against Google on this. And Google has stopped doing much so far. So a little bit more here. Regulations. We don't got none. Basically, the Internet is unregulated. There's only one effective regulation on the Internet today, and that is DNS squatting. If you go out and you get a DNS name, a domain name system name, like Ford Parts R Us, Ford Motor Company come along and say, no, that's our trademark and you can't have that. And the U.S. government has rules that if you try and do this and with the intent of selling it to Ford, it'll cost you $150,000. It's a fine of up to $150,000. So you better not do that. And there has been thousands of cases up until this law was passed, and the law has been pretty effective. But all the other things, fraud, there's a lot of fraud on the Internet. It's the same kind of fraud you got in the telemarketers and the paper trails. It's people being conned into buying lakefront property that's under 6 feet of water, that sort of thing. And it just happens all the time. CAN spam is the act that was supposed to control spam, but it's actually a permission to spam act. The U.S. government says every company in the world can send you one piece of spam as long as it has some mechanism in there for you to say, don't send me any more. So that means you're going to get 40 million pieces of spam, and that's legitimate. This is a stopping spam law? I don't think so. Communications Decency Act, this was the U.S. government saying trying to control porn on the net. And in the CDA, I was a witness for the American Library Association opposing the CDA. CDA said that you personally, if you wanted to send something on the Internet that somebody anywhere in the world that was under 18 shouldn't see, then you personally had to take effective action, and those words effective action were in the law, to ensure that nobody did. Now, that's not technically possible. That was irrelevant to Washington. They passed the law anyway. But it was relevant to the Supreme Court, and they said, out. And other anti-porn solutions haven't gone anywhere. But regulations are going to happen. There's no question that we're going to get regulations. Congress is busily working on it. Regulations all over the world. There are regulations other places, strong regulations in China. And there's strong regulations in a lot of countries. But in the U.S., there's activity in Congress right now. And it falls into two basic categories. One is the openness. The openness say that the network has to be neutral. In other words, it has to support the end-to-end model. You can't let the network providers get in the way of what you can do. That's the openness. Now, part of the openness also say you've got to let different Internet service providers be able to use that same wire into your house or your cable modem or your DSL line. You've got to be able to let multiple use that. That's not as much push these days. But the ones which network neutrality is a very important piece. The alternative to that is deregulationists. This is Michael Powell in the FCC, and a lot of the big telephone companies are deregulationists, which say, it's our wire, let us do what we want with it. If we want to block you from using something, then we can block you from using something because it's our property, and as long as you don't get in our way and let us make a profit, then we'll invest in new deployments.
That's going back to the original net that they were all laid down on and trying to...
Well, it's a little... Actually, in the early days, and actually up until now, the Telecom Act of 36 34 and then 96 actually put a lot of constraints over what telephone companies could do with the service. They couldn't block you from calling particular phone numbers. And it's something called common carrier, which provided requirements on them for deploying phone service in poor parts of the country, and lots of constraints on them. The deregulations say, get rid of all those constraints. It's my wire. I'm competing against with somebody else with a different wire, and the competition will make everything good. The deregulationists say that because Comcast has a wire into my house and Verizon has a wire into my house, and when they're competing for my internet service, one of them will not block what I can do, and that will drive the other one to not block what I can do. But it happens that both block what you can do. So this is a flawed concept. Now, if wireless comes along in addition, maybe that would drive them. But at the moment, both cable companies and telephone companies have an incentive to block what you can do so that they can get a piece of the action. So this is what's going on in the debate in Washington right now, between those two groups. The FCC issued a set of four principles last month. These are principles. These aren't actually regulations. These aren't actually laws. They're just sort of principles, good things to think about. Consumers are entitled to access to the lawful Internet content of their choice. Note the word lawful. Who defines lawful? In China, lawful is very different than it is here. In Orange County, California, lawful might be different than it is in New Orleans, Louisiana, or in Las Vegas. So who defines lawful? Consumers are entitled to run applications and use services of their choice, as long as law enforcement says that's okay. So maybe law enforcement says you can't have secret mail to your friend. And, well, under this principle, the law enforcement could say that. Law enforcement could check out applications before they're deployed. We've never had that before. The Internet, anybody's been able to put up any application they wanted to do anything they want to do, as long as it's the actual function is lawful. It can't do child porn, but the function is lawful. And nobody has to check it in advance. Nobody has to give you a license for it. You just go do it. Now, this principle says law enforcement can check first. We'll have to see how that goes. Customers are entitled to connect your own computers to the network. As long as they don't, it's legal devices. We don't know what legal means. And they don't harm the network. So this means, what's harmed the network? Back a long time ago, the telephone company, AT&T, had a rule that you couldn't connect anything that would harm the network. They sued somebody over a little piece of plastic. The case is called the Hushaphone case. And the little piece of plastic was on those old crank-tight little phones, the phones they used to have that you see in old movies, which is a stand and a little headpiece you pick up and put on your ear and you talk into the thing. Well, it was a little piece of plastic to put over the microphone there to put around your mouth to direct the sound so that less background noise would get in so the person on the other end could hear you better. And AT&T claimed that was harming the network because the sound was so amplified that the operators were going to go deaf. The AT&T representative said this in court to a judge, and the judge basically looked at him and said, you got to be kidding. and threw it out, throughout the case. So AT&T lost that, and you can connect stuff up. But who's going to say what harms the network? Does your computer harm the network if it can send a lot of traffic? If it can demand better quality service? What is going to be the criteria for harming the network? And finally, this one which says, yeah, you should be able to have competition. So these principles are very caveated in a way which is potentially very dangerous.
What I recall an incident, I think, from back 2000, when a guy in the Philippines sent a lot of internet virus and a lot of computers were cracked down. What do you say about that?
Well, that is most definitely, that's not just the guy, it's the guy in the Philippines was caught doing it. It was a guy in Amsterdam, I think, was caught last year. It happens all the time. And that is not clear where that would fit into this, because the device, his computer, didn't harm the net. It's what he did with his computer that harmed the net. The virus that he sent out harmed the net. It wasn't that. It's not clear what these principles would have relative to that particular case, or any case where somebody creates a virus or a worm and sends it out. It's illegal to do that. But it's... There are two different categories. Well, there's worms and viruses. The term virus came from a science fiction book called When Halley Was One, back in the 50s, I think it was, or 60s. It was a guy, this was early computers. This was very early science fiction. It was early computers. They were connected up with telephone wires, and one computer could call up another computer and send data over, just like make a phone call. Well, somebody wrote a program called Virus, all in capital letters, because that's the way they talked about computer programs in those days, called Virus. And he inserted Virus into one of the computers, and it called up other computers and transferred the virus over to the other computers. And the reason he did this was because he wanted to sell a program called Antidote, also in capital letters, to rub out the viruses. It turns out that actually the virus got corrupted in one of the phone calls and then was no longer worked. The antidote no longer worked, and everything went to hell in a handbasket. So viruses are, there's worms and viruses, and they're used the terms are used interchangeably, but there's basically two different concepts. One is where the user has to do something. So I send you an email message, and you click on the email message, and that causes a program to run which makes a copy of the email message and sends it to everybody that you know, because it sends it to everybody in your mail list. That's one type. The other type is called ones where it does not require any operator intervention at all. And the slammer worm was one of those. Slammer went out and it attacked a known vulnerability in the Windows operating system by sending a packet to desktop computers around the world, and that packet caused the computer to do the same thing. It basically caused the computer to run a little program, download some software, and then attack other computers. So the two different kinds are the ones where operator intervention, just why you should never click on an attachment that from a message that you're not really sure where it came from, because a great percentage of those are viruses that will then propagate around based from your mailing list. And you should be running a personal firewall on your computer and turn off all of the ports you're not actually using in order to prevent the second type. Slammer was particularly impressive because every computer, there was a certain category of computers that was running this software as vulnerable, Microsoft software. And it was about 100,000 or so computers in the world, 80% of them that were theoretically capable of being infected were infected within 10 minutes. All over the world, within 10 minutes, they're all gone. So it's not something a human operator could get in there and stop. It was just too fast. And that's as a researcher that worked on this called it, before it happened, he predicted this and said it was going to be the Warhol worm. Worm would be, within 15 minutes, it would have been, everything's all over. This is Andy Warhol saying, everybody's going to be famous for 15 minutes. Those aren't going to go away, and regulations aren't going to stop them. Good sanitary behavior on your part, of putting a personal firewall on your computer, turning it on, and configuring your computer correctly, and putting up patches do slow it down and can eliminate it primarily. But other than that. Other thing FCC has done is wiretapping laws. The wiretapping statutes, they have recently extended wiretapping to the Internet. They've proposed extending it to the Internet. They haven't done it yet because they've done a rule set that they've put into the Federal Register, but it has 30 days for comments, and then it'll be sued. And my full expectation is that the FCC will lose this suit, because the way they did it violates the powers that they have been given under statute. But when they lose it, Congress is going to give it back to them, so it's going to continue, but initially they'll lose it. Some very stupid, ridiculous things in this particular order. One thing, for example, is something like Skype, a internet-based voice over IP phone system. If you were to set up a voice over IP phone system that didn't talk to anybody on the regular phone system, then you're exempt from wiretapping. That's fine. Because actually they have under the law, they don't have any authority over that condition. But how about if you make a connection to the phone company so that people that are using your service can call to their buddies on the regular telephone service? Under the exact wording that the FCC came out, if you only let that happen, then you're not covered either. But if you had people so that people could call out from you and people could call back into you, then you're subject to it. But either calling out or calling in by itself doesn't make you subject. Don't make any sense at all. But that's the way it works. The U.S. House of Representatives has been working on a proposal. Senate did one earlier to replace the Communications Act. And this is some words out of theirs. It's actually very, very good for network neutrality. It says that an Internet service provider can't block or otherwise impair or impede access to services and content. It's a very good piece. But preempts state and local control, that's also good, so the local municipality can't put taxes on or say that you can't run it because it's competing with something they're doing. But all types of providers have to register with government. So if you set up that little voice over IP phone network, you'd have to register. And the government could turn you down, saying you couldn't do it. We've never had the requirement to register any Internet service to date. No Internet service provider, no voice over IP provider, no application provider. Google didn't have to register. We've never had to register anything. But this proposal has everything registered. An ominous trend. So I talked about the end-to-end principle. It's a great principle. In reality, it's not there anymore. That's because there's things in the network, mostly at the boundaries, at the enterprise edges and at ISP edges, and even at your home, which block that transparency, block the end-to-endness of the network. So if you've got a computer at your business, at where you work, there is no chance that you can bring up any application you want to, because the corporate firewall will block it. That's no longer transparent. There's no longer the end-to-end model working between your computer on your desktop at work and somebody else. And at home, you're probably using a NAT, a network address translator, in order to get more computers on than the one address that the carrier provides to you. And then you've got government issues like China blocking access to bad sites like Google. Pennsylvania had a law which blocked access to child porn sites, except the only way to do that is block IP address. Same IP address can be used by 10,000 websites in these hosting centers. And sure enough, when this happened, the Pennsylvania Attorney General handed a note to an ISP saying block this IP address or block this domain. That resolved in an IP address. The ISP blocked the IP address. It blocked the Spanish language hosting site, which had 10,000 sites on it. All in all, Pennsylvania caused ISPs to block 50,000 websites in order to block 470 or so that might have had child porn on them. The court said that's a little excessive and kicked it out, and Pennsylvania decided not to appeal it. We can't trust the net anymore. Can't trust it for wiretapping. Anybody can be wiretapping. If you happen to be using wireless, somebody can listen in on the wireless. You can't trust the IP address at the other end because of network address translators translate them. Used to be that you could identify somebody's computer by what IP address it was. Now you can't because there could be 500 computers that have used that same address. When you do www.cnn.com or google.com, you're not talking to Google or you're not talking to CNN. You're talking to Akamai. You're talking to a distributed set of servers which is mirroring the contents in order to make it more available. I mentioned that CNN was unavailable during 9/11, and that's because they had one set of servers. And the pipes to those servers got overloaded with people trying to figure out what the heck was going on. Well, by four hours after the planes hit, they were back up again. And they were back up again because they had employed Akamai, which is a distributed server system, which has hundreds of thousands of servers around the world, and made copies of the CNN content out there. So that when you went to CNN, it went to a local Akamai server instead of to the CNN headquarters. And therefore, you could get it because there were fewer people accessing that local server. But you can't trust that you're actually talking to CNN. It could be a hacked Akamai server that's feeding you back bad information. There's made no way to know. And if you receive email from God, it's probably spoofed source address. It's trivial to get spoof a email source address. So how do you do security in this kind of environment? I mentioned security is one of the biggest issues we've got in the net. You do security because it's an end-to-end thing. The end system itself has to be secure, which is why when you were asking about viruses and stuff, I say that you have to configure your host properly. You have to run your own firewall inside your host, inside your machine at home. That's the security has to be there. When you're using a secure web browser, talking to your bank or something, that's end-to-end security. It's security from your web browser to the bank server. You don't have to rely on the security of the Internet service provider or the wireless network or anything else in between because it's the end-to-end principle operating there, end-to-end encryption. But end-to-end encryption kind of bothers the law enforcement folks because when they wiretap you, they get a bunch of garbage bits because they can't interpret them because it's all encrypted. So they're undoubtedly going to push to try and outlaw that kind of encryption, which, of course, makes the rest of the world less secure, but makes it so that the law enforcement can go after the people they need to. They think they need to. This is a concept tussle, also from Dave Clark, which basically says there were real discussions, there were real issues in the Internet. Encryption is exactly an example of one of those real issues. And you can design the network, you design the technology such that the decision point is buried inside it. If it's buried inside it, then you've got a choice between this technology and that technology, and it forces a bad choice. But if you design the network correctly, you can design it so that there's a logical boundary which you can use to make a decision. An example of that is this quality of service issue. Quality of service is the ability to define what characteristics, what bandwidth, what latency, things like that, of the traffic that you're transporting. So you can say, I want to run video, so I'm going to want a lot of capacity, I want a lot of data, because video takes a lot of data, I'm going to want all of that. And you can say that. But you could do it two different ways. One is that the carrier could know what you're doing by looking at the application, looking at the characteristics of the application, the port number or the packet stream and things like that, and make a decision as to what service to provide. Or the end node could ask for the service it wants. If it's the network figuring out what you want and then doing it for you, then when you come up with a new application, you won't get the service you want. That's a bad tussle boundary, because then the decision is not one where it's easily manipulatable. Whereas if it's the end node saying, I want this kind of service, then the end node can make that decision based on what application is running, even if it's a brand new application no one's ever seen before. So there's an example of where you would want you can put the tussle boundary at the end system asking for service rather than the network understanding what you're doing. It's a far better thing to do. But all of what we've been talking about has put a lot of pressure, the security and things like that, have put a lot of pressure on blocking end-to-end. and put up the firewalls, put up the secure tunnels, all of that kind of stuff. Enterprises put up firewalls to protect the enterprise. You put up a firewall in your machine to protect your machine. So there's pressure to block end-to-end. But end-to-end is what got us here. And it was extremely important. It wasn't just that it's the freedom for you to do anything. It's an enabler of innovation. I mentioned that Star 6-9 took 10 years to develop in the phone company. It took a very long time because this was something where you had to convince the managers of the phone system that it was something that was going to make them money. Whereas almost all of the developments in the Internet have been individuals, little individuals, getting together to do something. They didn't have to be convinced that they were going to make money. They could. Some of them just did it for the fun of it. Some of them did it because they thought they were going to make money. But the end-to-end model being there meant that they could experiment and others could benefit from it without having to convince the phone company or the company firewall manager to enable what you're doing. And that's a big thing. Now, it does create chaos. It's very chaotic. You can't predict what the growth cycle of the Internet is going to be. You can't predict what the new application is. You can't predict Google Maps. Google Maps is a stunning piece of work. Nobody could have predicted that a couple of years ago. But that's enabled by the end-to-end picture, because Google as an individual company can go out and experiment like that. You don't depend on AT&T or Verizon doing that experimentation. You're allowing the end systems to do it. The deregulationists believe that big companies do best innovation because they're the ones with the money for doing the research. In reality, everything has been done by not by the carriers. It's been done by the end systems. So we got a non-transparent net, and you have to get permission to do things. And that's a real problem. So it's a problem because you can't go out and create your own little application and get some people to sign up for it. But it's also a problem in that the way innovation works, the way technology works in general, is dependent on how well you understand the problem. If you understand exactly what customers are going to want, then everybody who approaches the problem will do exactly that. If you know exactly that all the customers really want little pink bunnies on their screens, and they actually all do want little pink bunnies on the screens, then every vendor is going to put little pink bunnies on the screen, and every vendor will get about the same percentage of the market, and they'll all get commodity. They won't make much money because everybody is going for the same application and getting the same service. But what happens if you have no idea at all what the customer wants? Then you can experiment with little pink bunnies, and you can experiment with little blue rabbits, whatever. And the one of you that guesses right, as long as the network enables you to do that guessing and experimenting, is the one that's going to make almost all of the money, because you're the one who's going to meet the customer requirements. You're going to make almost all the money until the other vendors catch up and say, oh, they want pink bunnies. And then they'll all do the pink bunnies, and everybody will stop making money. But in between, you would have made a bundle. This is market uncertainty. If you're not certain of what the market is, then there's a tremendous value for the one that guesses the market correctly, guesses the customer correctly. But that's not going to be done by a central carrier with a very long development cycle. It's going to be done in an end-to-end environment where individuals who just can think of things will do something. iMode is a phone service that's available in Japan. And iMode is set up in such a way that the telephone company does provide some services. They provide they're involved in about 4,000 services that you can get over your cell phone. That's 4,000 out of 80,000. There's 76,000 services which third parties, you could create an iMode service. Anybody can create one. You don't have to have permission of the cell phone company to do it. Anybody can do it. The example service, Hello Kitty. Hello Kitty is a little cartoon characters. Pretty little cute little cartoon characters. Somebody came up with the idea of creating a service to download cartoon characters to the cell phone screen and sell subscriptions to do that. Now, what venture capitalist in their right mind would have supported that? Nobody would have. It doesn't make any sense at all. They got up to 1.6 million subscribers at $1 a month. So they're clearing $1.6 million a month for cartoon characters to your cell phone. And that was enabled by the fact the telephone company let anybody experiment who wanted to. Now, telephone company made money off of that because it made their service more valuable, and they charge a monthly fee for that service. And also, they collect money for transporting packets. So little cartoon characters, when they're being transported, made telephone company some money. So they're making a few hundred grand a month directly off of this. And also, just because it's easier, the Hello Kitty people asked the telephone company to do billing, to put the $1 a month charge on the telephone bill. And so they collected 9% for that. So the telephone company's making money at that, but it's making money because it enabled others to do innovation. It didn't try to do all the innovation itself. The president of the Docomo iMode was at Harvard recently, and he said that was his big fight. His big fight was the telephone company was a mindset, which is the telephone company will provide the applications the customers needed, period. And this openness is silly because we don't get like any value from the openness. And it took him a long time to convince them that, yes, we can get those 76,000 other services, making our service more valuable by doing that. But the telephone company still, most recently, said, oh, somebody's using our iMode service to connect to banks and to e-commerce sites and to buy Coca-Colas in the machine. We want a piece of that action. So we want to block all sites, access all e-commerce sites that we haven't set up a business relationship with. Which, of course, is exactly the fight that this guy was trying to say that wasn't the right path. And he did win again, but it was another big fight because the telephone company bosses thought that they deserved a part of that value stream. And if they had, that would have reduced the number of sites that you could do that with considerably because you'd have to work out a business relationship first. And so that would have hurt innovation. So a combination of the end-to-end principle and the market uncertainty principle means that the end-to-end environment is extremely valuable for innovation. Google and Skype can show that to you. Neither of them needed permission from the network to work, and both of them have done very, very well for themselves. And who's going to be the next Skype? Who's going to be the next Google? We don't know. But if we block the nets, then we will never know. So some random comments. Internet service provider. In the traditional world, a telephone carrier is the place where a lot of money is. And certainly the local telephone carriers still have money. Internet service providers aren't making money. So places with money, which the telephone company don't have any idea of what the Internet is, places with idea what the Internet is don't have any money. So it's not a particularly good balance there. We'll have to see how that will work. Particularly the telephone companies assume that they're going to make money off of content, that you're going to want to watch Lost or something like that, and you're going to pay them a lot of money to do that, or watch movies, and you're going to pay them a lot of money to do that. But if they thought about it for more than 2.5 minutes, they'd figure out that's not right. The telephone business in the U.S. is about $260 billion a year. The total entertainment business is about $60. So if they get 100% of the entertainment business, it's not a big chunk of money compared to what they're already making. And getting 100% of the entertainment business is not likely because they're going to go up against the competition of the cable company, which has installed infrastructure which costs a lot less to run than the telephone company infrastructure does and can compete just fine and will reduce their prices till the phone company's not making any money on the content. So the content is, as one of the researchers put it, content is not king, even though phone companies think it is, and you will see that Verizon and others are pushing these new services that will let them make cable TV provided cable TV over fiber optics to your house, even though you've already got cable over wireless like the satellite or over coax cable from the cable company. Verizon is going to come in and do the same thing. So now I got three different places to compete with each other, reducing the prices to nothing, and Verizon can't afford to pay off the debt that it's going to incur for putting in the infrastructure to support it. In the traditional telephone world, the telephone company owns you. The user is owned by the carrier, and the carrier can tell you what services you can get and how you're going to pay for them. On the Internet, that's not true. And it's not clear how that's going to work out because ISPs, without the business model of just selling packets, aren't going to make a profit. And the business model of selling content isn't going to make it. Content will never be king. It had not been to date. Back a number of years ago, There was a big trial of video on demand in Orlando, Florida. Really fancy trial and really nice equipment. You could select any video you wanted and start and stop it, just like a VCR. Start and stop, and it was, and at one point that got down to 99 cents a video. You could pay 99 cents, you could get any one of thousands of videos. And yet, in Orlando, Florida, more people who had this service in their house, it had been installed for free, who had service in their house, were going out to Blockbuster to rent videos at $2 a night, instead of renting the video which they could just get with their remote control for 99 cents. The phone company who put up that service never was able to answer the question why. Why did they go out to Blockbuster rather than just use the one they've got? Had a bunch of theories, but they couldn't answer that. Until he can answer that question, content is certainly going to be a very tough sell. The Internet is a significant problem on the area of social pressures. It does disrupt governments. China is extremely concerned, as a fellow from Beijing once put it to me, of information that would confuse the citizens, i.e. information that was different than the information the government was providing. And what do you do about that? Governments appeal that to protect the citizens, whether it's against content or against fraud or whatever. That's one of government's roles in government's mind anyway, is to protect you as a consumer. And you know, that's why we have the FDA and the like, although there are people who want to abolish the FDA and say that, you know, if you take that drug and it kills you, don't take it again. That kind of model is out there. But there's a lot of applications that people are playing with, putting on the Internet, but there's an awful lot of them aren't really thinking very well. What they're doing is imitation. They're taking the traditional telephone world and putting it on top of IP. With all the traditional telephone functionality, it looks like a telephone. It acts like a telephone. Vonage is that. It's just, if you look at the Vonage website, that's a telephone company. It's everything on that is what you get out of a telephone company. There's nothing IP-ish about it. There's nothing Internet-ish about it. There's no interaction between it and web servers and stuff. So are we going to have the traditional telephone world or a traditional application of one kind or another just running over IP with no new features? Or are we going to have something that's Internet voice, which it realizes that the Internet is more than just a transport system? You have things like web browsers and Google and all that stuff, so that you can have something extremely simple. So you have a Google, you look up the web, you look up that restaurant, click on the little button, and it places a call for you. That would be a different kind of interaction. It'll be an interaction where you never need the phone number. You just click on the button saying call a restaurant. And that would be a different kind of voice service to do that. So what we get now is an awful lot of imitation. And that is really, this is a psychology professor sticking out his tongue and a baby sticking out the tongue and imitation. We get that a lot. We get that direct imitation without really understanding of how to think about pushing the boundaries to get something new. So what's today's Internet? Talked all about the theory and the practice, but now what's today's Internet? Today's Internet is this. It's porn, it's spam, it's the recording industry, gambling, firewalls. This is a wall with China behind it. But yes, I know that's an Inca wall. It's not a Chinese wall. Somebody from Beijing got really... South America got really upset that I used this picture of a wall pretending it's a Chinese wall. I know it's not. The Internet is not transparent anymore. It's not secure. Wi-Fi is coming along. Nobody makes money. Firewalls, one of the things about firewalls is the hole in a firewall for port 80, which means if you want to run any application, just run it over port 80, which is over the web protocol. This is a RFC that one of the grad students here and I wrote, RFC 3093. It's a part of the Internet Standard Series. That is called the Firewall Enhancement Protocol. And that says take TCP/IP and put it over port 80. So then you can run any application you want over that, over port 80, and get through the firewall. And of course, that defeats the purpose of the firewall, but it enhances it in the concept of end-to-end. It enhances it to allow end-to-end again. This. That is a patent. That is a U.S. patent. An honest-to-goodness U.S. patent. Person, 12. Sits with device, handheld device, 10. Shines invisible beam of light, 14. To create spot on the floor, 22, in front of the cat, 20. Moves spot around, cat chases spot, cat gets exercised. This is the, where is it? Yeah, this is a method patent of how to use a laser pointer, which this is supposed to be. There it is. How to use a laser pointer to exercise a cat. And somebody got a patent for that. Mm-hmm. And a patent system that will give out patents like that is really not going to make innovation very easy. But that's part of the structure we have today. So that's today's Internet. The phone company is trying to help make the Internet work. The regulators don't like chaos, so they want to get rid of chaos. Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, said that it was one of government's roles was to guide technology. Somehow I don't want the House of Representatives to decide what technology should look like in the U.S. I think that would not be a good way to foster innovation. I'd rather do without their help, but that's the way it goes. There's a bunch of myths about the Internet. There's a myth that it's free. It's not. Everybody's always had to pay for it. Harvard's always had to pay for its Internet connection. A myth that it's flat rate. It's not. The big connections are always variable rate. You don't get to send everything you want. Google has to pay for the link, for the traffic it sends. Government run or funded, it's neither. There's very little money going into the Internet from the U.S. government or any other government. It's a purely commercial environment now. I pay a lot of money for my connection at home. Harvard pays a lot of money here. It's not just the U.S. Well, or the U.S. owns it. Well, actually, that's maybe not that much of a myth. It happens that just in the last few weeks, there was a big blow-up. The U.S. government right now controls the top level of domain name system, which is the harvard.edu or .fr, France, top level code. There is a table which describes what those are. That is under the thumb of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Commerce said, we're not letting go, and told the rest of the world to go suck eggs. We're not letting go. This didn't make the rest of the world very happy. There's a big meeting in Tunis next month in which the rest of the world will probably tell the U.S. government to go suck eggs. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work out, but it doesn't sound good. It's regulation-free in the U.S., but it's not regulation-free in China. We have no viable business model. There's a myth that there's a viable business model for the Internet. Google makes a lot of money, but the Internet service provider bringing Google to your desktop doesn't make any money. Inherent poor quality, actually the quality is extremely good most of the time, which is why Skype and Vonage and things like that will work. It's because it almost always works. It is not the right answer for all telecommunications things, even though some people think so. So the people that are making money at the Internet are the people at the ends, like Google, or the people that are building the infrastructure, like Cisco.
Sorry, how does Google make money?
They sell advertising.
Yeah,
it's advertising. And they do pretty good at that, because it's advertising that's has learned about you, knowing what kinds of things you're interested in by watching what you're scanning, what you're searching for, and then giving ads that are relevant to that. So the click-through on the Google ads that are being produced, knowing your background, are far higher than the random ads that you get when the website doesn't know who you are. You know, 13-year-olds getting advertisements for cars. It's not going to be a very successful thing. That sort of stuff. The problem with the Internet, though, is this business model question. John McQuillan is a big businessman. I was at a panel of his at a big conference, and I said that this conference was old hat. It was all old telephone stuff because it was old telephone companies trying to describe how they were going to facilitate their infrastructure with the Internet, but leave the model the same, which is that they own the customer and the service would be only what they would provide and things like that. So that's not the Internet model. The Internet model is you go down to Radio Shack and you buy a phone, you plug it into your net at home, and you make phone calls, and the phone and the and the carrier doesn't know you're making the phone call, and the person on the other end is the only person who knows that you're making the phone call, and no, you're not paying anybody anything extra for a phone call. And John said, well, who's going to make money at that? And I said, Radio Shack. And that didn't go down well, because this was a big venture capital conference, and they didn't think that Radio Shack was a good venture capital play. There's a lot of stuff going on in the non-standards part of this world, and that is internet governance. This is the meeting that's going to be in Tunis next month, the one that the U.S. government told to go suck eggs. This is WSIS, W-S-I-S. If you're interested in politics, that's a good one to go to. It looks like the vote in that session in Tunis may be 168-1. With 168 countries saying, we want to go this way, and U.S. saying, we want to go that way. It'll be an interesting thing. A lot of people don't like chaos, and the WSIS really doesn't like chaos. This is governments getting together. They want to make it so the internet is predictable, controllable, won't confuse the citizens, and we'll see. This is the chart I mentioned. There's a competition chart. This is the top one here is long distance cost. Cost for long distance phones using 1980 using relative numbers. It's in 1984 that was about 170. It's now down here at under 20, whatever the units are. This is cellular costs. This is the local cost, local loop cost.
So your math isn't quite.
Hmm?
So the math isn't, the key isn't quite
matched. Well, that's just because there's something funny about this projector.
Oh, okay.
That line is green,
okay.
That one's red, and that one's yellow. Can't you take? This one is, the top one is green, which is cellular. This one is long distance. And this one is the local loop. And you can see the local loop price has gone up because it's regulated, local regulation. The others have gone down dramatically because there's real competition. So competition's a good thing. So let's look at, in the last few minutes here, look at some of the ways that we might go forward. One alternative is governments. U.S. saying, we built it, we own it, we're going to run it. WSIS saying, the rest of the world owns it, and you're going to hand it over. Traditional phones over IP, no innovation. The FCC, Homeland Security, the UN, the proposal is to actually get the UN to run the Internet. That's the proposal out of WSIS right now. Boy, that's going to be innovative. So that's one option is government run. Another option is telephone company run, traditional carriers, where it's voice, it's video on demand, not iMode, not the ability for any one of 76,000 people to come up with their own service. You have to get it through the company. Telefonica, well, different phone companies. The big players in their picture is video on demand and games. Those are the things that you're going to pay a lot of money for, and you're going to make them make money. In the original telephone world, if you look back in the original ads for the original telephone back in a long, long time ago, what were those ads say that you could do with a telephone? You could call the local market. You could call your doctor. You could call a horseshoer, the blacksmith. But they didn't talk about me talking to you. They didn't talk about talking to your friends. That wasn't part of the picture. None of this picture here of what the Internet is me talking to you. It is not me putting up a website and you looking at it. It's not me sending you email. It is not person-to-person communication. It is all assuming you want content. And the content will rule your life, and you'll sit there like a potato in front of the computer screen instead of the TV screen, and they're going to make money every time that you blink. So that's one picture. That's another picture. Here's another picture. This is Manhattan. Each of those little orange dots, which are actually red, but they're orange, is an open Wi-Fi access point. 9,600 of them in 2002. 9,600 open Wi-Fi sets. There are a number of cities, San Francisco, Philadelphia being the prime big ones. They're setting up community-wide Wi-Fi networks. Google has bid to do the San Francisco one. It would be free. Just walk into San Francisco and open up your laptop and start using the Internet. in Manhattan, down here around Bryant Park, down in the southern part of Manhattan. It's the local municipality, not the city, but the local business district, has put up free wireless, free hotspot wireless, free internet connectivity. Their aim is to, within a 5-minute walk of any place in lower Manhattan, you can get an internet connection for free. So that's another model, which is that the old model of the internet, which was cooperative local agreements, is what will drive the future. So those three options. So what's the future going to look like? I don't know. But here's some interesting things. These are decisions that I think made a difference to where we got here. Supporting existing networks, don't try and build your own. A datagram base, not circuit base, so that you have this multiplexer function. A router function which allows you to build cheap networks. Split TCP/IP. The original idea was that TCP/IP was one protocol, everything was reliable. By splitting those two things up, which was done very early, you made it so that reliability was an option that the application could ask for. And the level of reliability was an option the application could ask for. Now you say, well, why would you not want reliability? Well, actually, you don't want reliability for voice. Reliability is obtained by watching to see whether you've lost data, lost packets, and retransmitting them if you do. But voice, it's important that voice gets there within a reasonable period of time, 150 milliseconds. If you have to wait, see if any packets are lost, and retransmit them, it'll take longer for the voice to get there. And what happens is, if you have a real conversation, if you and I were having a real conversation, which we're not right now, but if we were having a real conversation, I would pause every now and then to see whether you wanted to say anything. If I were remotely polite, I'd stop every now and then to see whether you wanted to say anything. And that pause in North American white males, which is where the research was done, is about 300 milliseconds. Hey, I just report the facts. That's about 300 milliseconds. If I don't hear you start talking within 300 milliseconds, I assume that you're not going to say anything and I continue. So if there's a latency in the network of more than 300 milliseconds, I will stop and I'll wait for you to say something. And I don't hear you saying something, even though you have started to say something, the sound hasn't gone back to me, I will start talking again, and now we're talking both at the same time. This is a phenomenon you hear on the satellite phones. You hear it all the time of people talking over each other because it's this. So reliability would increase the latency, so you don't want reliability in a voice service. So this split allowed the application to decide what reliability it wanted, what latency it wanted to deal with, and all that kind of stuff. The U.S. government paid to get TCP/IP put into Unix and then made that available widely, so the companies weren't inventing their own protocols. I mentioned the CSNet deal, which allowed us at Harvard to open up the ARPANET to every person at Harvard. Tremendously important. There was a requirement of using TCP/IP on NSFNet, which was a second generation federally funded network. Big issue was the traditional standards bodies were given the option of taking over the TCP/IP standardization, and they turned it down. If they had accepted it, it's the telephone companies that are the members of that traditional standards body, and they would have turned it into a telephone protocol with all central services. Because they turned it down, the standardization stayed with Internet geeks in the Internet Engineering Task Force, IETF, IETF.org, and which meant that we kept growing things that worked from the edges rather than assuming the core. NSF said you couldn't use the backbone, the U.S. government-funded backbone for commercial purposes. That meant there had to be a set of commercial Internet providers created because there was a lot of business you want to do. Google couldn't run over the NSFNet because it's commercial, because it does advertising. You couldn't do that there. But the fact the U.S. government said, Uncle Sam is not going to carry this for you for free, that meant that commercial networks had to be created, and we've had minimal regulation. And that turned out to actually be a decision. The FCC decided not to regulate. So those were big, important decisions. There are decisions that we need to make now. Do we punch a hole in that wall to China? Do we do what Panama did a while back, which is try to block voice over IP because the local telephone company had a monopoly on international calls, and therefore they wanted to block people using voice over IP? Of course, it lasted about 15 minutes until the people running voice over IP changed their ports to a different set of ports. But still, the concept was there. They tried to stop the use of the Internet for this function. We've got standards, who's going to do standards, what's security, privacy, the business model for the Internet, and what the regulations are going to be. Those are decisions that we make today, decisions that we're going to make going forward. The key questions on anything like this is who says who makes the rules, not who makes the rules, because there's different people who make rules for different things. The FBI makes rules for one thing, Homeland Security another, the standards people for other things. Who says who makes the rules for what? Who gives the authority to say, you make rules for this area? And who says who pays for what? There's a lot of infrastructure here, domain name servers and wires, and who says who pays for what part of that? Who makes those decisions? WSIS is trying to make those decisions. We'll see how that goes. WSIS is a purely governmental body. Only governments are allowed in the room, in the decision room. So it's no third parties, no public interest groups. It is only governments, and the governments are interested in what governments are interested in. So those are decision points. Those are things that we need to think about. We need to think about it now. People in this room are part of the decision process of thinking about what the Internet of the future is going to look like. What services are we going to get on it? What restrictions on services are we going to get on it? And I'm pessimistic, optimistic. Okay?
So what do you think the timeline is on all these decisions and regulations and
well, the
structure and all that?
Well, the big one is, the next one up is WSIS. Mm-hmm. That's the Antunes next month. And it's either going to come out of that with a decision or not. And if it comes out with a decision, it's most likely to be to try and wrest the control of the Internet away from the U.S.
Do you think the U.S. will allow that?
When the vote is 167-1, it's a little hard. That's not like this is a place that's supposed to be a majority vote. Mm-hmm. So what would happen if it were cut to that, what could happen is that the rest of the world would set up a different domain name system. So when you type IBM.com,
Euro.
So when you type IBM.com, you might get to the same place and you might not. Hmm. Anybody else?
I wish I could stay, but we have another thing to get to.
Bye-bye.